So good evening, everyone. And can you hear me okay in the back today? What I've been thinking about in relationship to meditation is that one way to understand meditation is that it is meant to make us an honest person. Make us honest about what's really going on. And I think it's often very hard in our lives to track what our thoughts are, what our feelings are, what our intentions are, what the assumptions are that we're operating on. There's often belief systems that are operating kind of, it's like the software, it's like the operating system behind the scene. And we might not understand that we have certain beliefs that we're operating on, but we see the world through those beliefs and those needs. And part of the function of meditation is to begin highlighting much of our lives which often go unnoticed. And one of the ways this works is if you sit down to meditate and to do something as simple as follow your breath, sooner or later you'll notice, and probably for many of you it's sooner rather than later, you'll notice that you're not with your breathing. Or you'll notice that your mind has wandered off into some thought or concern. You'll notice how quickly the mind leaves the breath. You might stay with the breath for one or two breaths or five or six breaths or something. And pretty quickly the mind wanders off to something else. If all you do is to come back to your breathing, sometimes that's helpful. Sometimes that trains us to let go of our preoccupation with other things, our attachments and the way the mind kind of grasps on to other kinds of things, and the mind begins to relax. But sometimes, by coming back quickly to the breath, letting go of the thoughts and concerns and coming back to the breathing, it can be another form of escape, where we're not really addressing and looking honestly at what's really going on in our lives. And there's a real important opportunity in meditation where the mind gets a little bit calmer than usual, where kind of actually our eyes are closed and kind of our inner life is highlighted a little bit more fully than it is when we're kind of running around taking care of many things in a busy life. And so there's an opportunity there to see more clearly what's actually happening for us. And so rather than coming back quickly to the breathing, sometimes it's very useful to linger a little bit with the kind of thoughts and concerns, the feelings that have arisen, so you can really be honest about what they are, so you can really see what they are. For some people, it's really being honest about that their mind is out of control. Wow, had no idea my mind was so busy. Not only, you know, when I stop to linger a little bit with the mind that wanders in thought, it's such a surprise. I'm not following one thought. I seem to be jumping all over the place. Or maybe you're following one thought, and every time I notice that my mind has wandered off into thought, it's always the same concern. It's like I'm like this one-track guy. You know, it must be more interesting thing to think about, but after the 25,000th time of thinking about that, you know, it's enough, isn't it? So to be alert, to be mindful, means to also be tracking what goes on inside of us. And if we're just trying to stay with the breath and hang on to the breath because the breath has a calming function, we might be missing part of the learning that can happen as part of the meditation process. So we want to be interested in what it is, where is it the mind goes, what is the tendencies, what are the habits, what are the impulses that drive the mind and drive the heart when we sit down to meditate. And in learning, kind of meditation is like a laboratory where you have a better opportunity to notice what your inner life is like. Because in daily life, it's often very hard to notice that. And so if you learn in a laboratory of meditation, then you maybe become familiar with the terrain. So when you leave meditation, you leave somewhat familiar. You know a little bit the map. You know your tendencies. And you can kind of notice these things more quickly. Like, for example, you might notice your common ways in which you relate to disappointment. If you're trying to stay with your breath in your meditation practice, and you can't stay with more than five or six breaths at a time, but you've heard that, or you've imagined that if you were a successful meditator, you would track every single breath for the whole half hour. You wouldn't miss an inhalation or an exhalation. You'd just be riding it perfectly. And so you notice that you're not succeeding with a perfect image of a meditator because you've managed the best six breaths. And so you're not living up to your ideal. And so you might get disappointed. Or not succeeding what you set yourself to do, you notice disappointment, you notice fear, you notice issues of self-image, you notice issues of what are other people noticing. The kind of ways in which we react to disappointment or to failure or to things not working out the way we want to work them out, we might notice that. And often, when you do meditation practice, the things you start learning are often the common tendencies that happen in daily life also. So if you have a common way of reacting to only having five or six breaths, only having one breath, or no breaths that you track for the half an hour, and then you realize that when they ring the bell, what is the reaction you have? And there's an opportunity there to learn that and see that clearly, and then you might be able to notice outside of here common tendencies of how you relate to things, to life when things don't work out the way you want them to work. And some of the ways in which we react are optional. They're arbitrary. They're learned. They belong to the particular quirks and of perception, of orientation that we have. And they might not really be accurate. It might not be true that anybody's watching your meditation as you're sitting here, tracking how many breaths you can follow. But I know there are a few people who are very concerned about what other people think, what the teacher thinks. The teacher must be watching, you know, and heaven forbid that I'm never going to admit that I only followed three breaths the whole half hour, because that would be too embarrassing. So you learn self-image is important. You might find out when you sit to meditate that you try to stay with the breath, and one of the things you notice is the mind is constantly going into planning mode. And it's easy enough to let go of and come back to your breathing, but you start planning again. And you start planning again, and start planning again. And it's possible, in seeing that in meditation, you can begin to recognize that in daily life, you're often running on planning mode, the mind spending a lot of time planning. And then in meditation, you have a chance to look at that more carefully, to find out what else is going on when I'm always planning. In daily life, it might be hard to track it or be interested in it. You have to take care of too many things. And you're running around. But in meditation, maybe you can begin studying. Why is it you spend so much time planning? What's going on? Or maybe after meditation, you want to reflect on this. You might maybe do some evaluation. Is it useful to spend my time in meditation planning? I seem to do a very thorough job doing planning 23 hours of the day otherwise, or all my waking hours otherwise. Do I have to also do it in meditation time? And certain kind of evaluation, reflections, thinking about things. But first we notice what our tendencies is, what our mind's doing. And then we want to evaluate it a little bit, understand a little bit what's going on, and see if we can bring a wiser understanding to our tendencies. Because if you can have a wiser understanding, then it might be easier to let go of it. Oh, I don't really need to do this now. This is not the time for this now. This actually helps keep my mind agitated. Okay, knowing that it keeps my mind agitated and it's not the path of peace, maybe then it could be more easy to let go of it and come back to the breath with some wisdom. If you come back to the breath as a jerk reaction, back to the breath, you know, back to the breath, with no wisdom, then you're not really creating the conditions to help you stay with the breath through time. Because then the conditions are there to keep bopping back into planning or remembering or talking or whatever goes on in your mind. So what I'm suggesting here this evening is that you want to use as much of your intelligence as you have available to you when you meditate. You don't have to be worried about being an intelligent person, but you want to use as much intelligence as you have, and everybody has some, to be alert to what's happening, to understand what's happening the best you can. And not to kind of use meditation only as a calming technique or soothing technique or, you know, something to pacify yourself, but really something to kind of clarify what's really going on in your life, to be honest about what's going on, and then, in a sense, sometimes even grapple with it. try to understand it better, try to evaluate it. Not to judge it good or bad, or judge yourself as being good or bad, but to understand better how important is this to follow? How important is it to really believe some of the things that the mind produces? Someone told me they saw a bumper sticker today, and the bumper sticker said, was it you, Margaret, who saw it?
Yeah, it said, don't believe everything your mind says.
Don't believe everything your mind says.
Or tells you. Don't believe everything your mind tells you.
Don't believe everything your mind tells you. I think that's a great bumper sticker. Now, certain things you should believe. But some people have a tendency of believing every thought they have, or every perception, or every judgment they have of the world around them. And a lot of our judgments about what goes on around us and other people are very biased. And the more you meditate, I think the more you start realizing how much bias goes into how we judge the world around us and ourselves. And so we use our intelligence to notice our tendencies to judge, to be judgmental. And we maybe can, to the best of our intelligence, evaluate it, try to bring some wisdom to it, some understanding to it, to try to bring a more compassionate relationship to it, to be more loving or gentle about what's happening in our lives. A lot of wisdom has to do about bringing compassion and kindness to our experience. So we begin changing our relationship to our experience when we meditate. We try to be honest about what's going on, and we try to change it to some degree by bringing some wisdom, some kindness, some compassion to what is there. Now, this kind of approach that I'm talking about this evening can lend itself to being very manipulative in meditation. Meditation is all about kind of figuring out and studying and changing and bringing wisdom and evaluating and all that. And you can feel very, very busy very quickly. It's not meant to be such a busy thing. But it's also meditation. It's not meant to be an absence of reflection or absence of intelligence or an absence of evaluation of your experience. And so each of you are going to have to decide for yourself where, you know, what's needed at any given time. Do you need to spend more time kind of studying and evaluating what's going on? Do you need to spend more time kind of being honest about what's really going on? Do you need to spend more time just staying with the breath and getting calmer? Do you need to spend more time kind of following that which brings rest and ease? So when I sit, for example, sometimes, some of the things I do is I stay with the breath. And then, but I'm not just tracking my breath. I'm also tracking what else is going on in my body. For example, where the tension might be, the agitation might be. And sometimes there's a certain amount of agitation that goes on for me in my brain, in my head, that has to do often with thinking. And if I'm going to follow the path of ease, of peace, of rest, I'll stay with the breath, but I'll also follow that sense, that scent, that intimation of rest that's available in my brain. And if I tune into that part of that's restful in the brain, rather than tuning into the thoughts the brain makes, then it's a lot easier for me to stay with the breath, and the mind becomes quieter and quieter. So, is there some felt sense of ease, of rest, of peace? It might just be a teeny bit, it might be just a hint of it that's available to you as you sit. And can you orient yourself towards that rather than the tendency of the mind orienting itself to discursive thought? Because discursive thought, for the most part, is not the path to peace, nor often is it the path to wisdom and compassion. So, what this means also, what I'm saying tonight, is that you don't need to be discouraged by a distracted mind. A distracted mind is just another thing for you to study and understand and become aware of. So if it's not easy for you to stay with your breath, don't worry about that. It'll become easier with time. But if it's not easy to stay with your breath, then study. What is it that makes it difficult to be with your breath? Get to know that. Rather than keep pounding your head against the wall of the breath, you know, it's like, oh, gotta do it, you know. But rather, be really honest. What's really going on? I'm really worried about what I said to someone today. And so you keep rehearsing the conversation. You keep thinking about what's going to happen when you see the person tomorrow. And all this rehearsal. And you study that and get to know it well, and you might understand that underneath it is fear. And if you can hang out with the fear, not think about it, but just hang out with it, the whole thing might settle in a useful way. One of the things that you might become aware of, as we kind of track and become more honest about our impulses, our thoughts, our feelings, our ideas, our intentions, our assumptions, is something which in the Buddhist tradition is considered very important. And that is the underlying sense of self-identity that is often the fertilizer or the soil out of which many of our thoughts, reactions, and emotions arise. And part of the function of Buddhist meditation is to help us eventually, slowly, begin looking at the deep underlying assumptions we hold about what it is to be a self. The self-image we have, the way we feel we have to represent ourselves to other people, the kind of self we feel like we need to be in order to be a good person, successful person, the right person, a whatever. All of us will have some image about who we are. And we relate to that image, or maybe number of images. We relate to that image often in ways which we cling. And that image that we hold on to then becomes a fuel for all kinds of other thoughts and concerns and emotions and feelings. So, for example, if you think that if your image of yourself is you're supposed to be a really good meditator, and you sit down to meditate one day and you can't concentrate very well at all, then your image of yourself as a good meditator is challenged. And you might get depressed. You might get sad, or you might get angry. And that those emotions of sadness, depression, and anger are arising because of that self-image that's there. Or say you sit down to meditate, and that day it's just pure samadhi. You sit down and the mind gets still, and it's great bliss, and white lights and great empty space, and you disappear, the world disappears, and you feel like you're in the brink of enlightenment, and you sure hope everyone notices. And you feel, and you feel really happy and elated, not just because you had a good meditation and it was very pleasant, but because it confirms the fact that now it's confirmed the fact that you are a very good meditator. And now you can really be proud of this thing. You can go into the meditation hall with pride and delight, and because your self-image has been supported. Certain people have certain ideas of self that come from childhood, things that their parents told them about themselves or their society, or the religion they grew up in had certain statements about what a self is supposed to be like. And so we carry that with us, often somewhat unconsciously or semi-consciously. And part of the value of meditation is if you're very honest about what's going on and you track the patterns and you kind of really see clearly, you're alert to what you're thinking about and the assumptions underneath what you're thinking about, and the mind is quiet enough, at some point you might notice that the common denominator of so many of your concerns, the surface concerns of your life, the common denominator, the root of them, has to do with some sense of self. Protecting it, enhancing it, creating it, representing it, making it into something, justifying it, all kinds of things. So part of the function, part of what mindfulness is to be alert and honest about what's going on. And we want to be honest in all directions. So, and as you're more honest about what's going on, you'll find that it becomes easier then to stay with the breath. I believe that's what will happen in the long term. If you're only trying to stay with the breath, and you're not also being alert to learn about the rest of your life, the rest of your life is going to keep leading you around by the nose. It's very helpful to stay with the breath, but it's also very helpful to be unsuccessful at it. Because if you're unsuccessful at it, then you can start noticing why. And then your meditation is successful. As soon as you start noticing what's going on, be honest about it. So be very careful about setting up some kind of ideal of what meditation is, that you measure yourself against negatively. Meditation is the very simple practice of being honest. You sit down to meditate to be honest. those are my thoughts for today. So now it's your turn for your thoughts or questions or concerns or anything you want to ask having to do with practice. Please.
So I'm new to this class. I had gone to a Zen meditation class, and so I would like to know what is the difference of the five goals between Vipassana and Zen.
There are many different schools of Zen, and there are many different schools of Vipassana. So it's a little bit hard to compare, you know, vegetables and fruits. And you know, it might be that the ultimate goal of Zen and Vipassana is tomatoes, and tomatoes are both a vegetable and a fruit, right? So, but it's a little bit hard because of the different schools to compare and contrast. But very generally, the goal of Zen and the goal of Vipassana is the same. Very mature Vipassana practice and mature Zen practice looks the same, but the way to get there is often a little bit different. And there's a wide range of differences in the meditation practices. If you're just focusing on the meditation practice itself, the beginner's practice tends to look different, the instructions for beginners. The tendency in Vipassana is to lay out the whole map of your inner experience that you kind of learn to track and pay attention to, and you kind of you're trying to explain to you, you know, the things you need to be in lookout for, the warned to pay attention to certain things. And whereas in Zen, you're actually told very little. You're given very little map, very little instructions, and you're often just told to sit and be present, or just sit and follow your breath. And for some people, that works very well. And for some Zen students, they tend to kind of flounder for years because they're not given any instruction about how to work with their emotions or their mind that thinks a lot. And for some people, Vipassana works really well because they're given a lot of instructions and given the map of the practice. But for some people, Vipassana practice doesn't work so well because it seems, the way they hear the instructions, it sounds like they have to be very busy. There's so much to track and so much to be aware of. And they just love Zen because it's so simple and so little you have to do. Just shut up and follow the breath. Something like that. So is that a helpful answer for you?
Zen is Vipassana more right brain feelings and Zen more left brain? Is that a good characterization?
I don't think I want to go there.
Controversial.
Ask the same question but with different words, different categories besides right and left brain.
More vibrant, rich, as opposed to empty or dry.
Vipassana
is thick with feelings and stuff. Zen is supposed to be empty. Is that true?
I thought when you first said it, I was thinking it was the opposite. There's so many different factors. You know, the human being is multidimensional, and so it depends a little bit on the dimension of our human being that you're looking at in order to answer that question. In some of our dimensions, I think Zen specializes in being more empty. In some dimensions, Zen specializes in being actually much more vibrant. And in some dimensions of our humanity, Vipassana is more vibrant, and in some dimensions, it's more empty. We're multidimensional beings. And that's why sometimes different religious traditions speak to different people more, because certain traditions emphasize certain dimensions more than others, and some certain individuals are focused more on certain dimensions of their personality. And but if you follow, I believe if you follow any Buddhist practice to its end, all the different aspects are harmonized or unified or are resolved. I think as these practices become mature, it's like all roads lead to Rome. But that's a faith statement. I can't really tell you that with great assurance that that's the case. Yes?
Before I came to Vipassana meditation, I used to do, I would sit in the morning. It would be probably just 10 minutes, and it would be in a chair, had no posture or anything like that. I would just sit. And my experience with that was that I got a lot of really good ideas about work. it was a very productive time, actually. And I guess I would call it contemplation. It was a sort of contemplating what's going on, and I get that. And, I was surprised. I mean, that would seem to be the biggest. Now when I come here, I have much more instruction, and I'm much more focused on being relaxed and calming the mind. And now I don't have a question. I'm just sort of curious. Does Vipassana meditation, I mean, it sounded to me like it does sort of broach into what I would have thought of as being contemplation, except that the focus is on our lifestyle or our thoughts or emotions or something like that.
The question is Vipassana more like contemplation?
Is it contemplative?
I would say it's not. It's not thinking. It's not thoughtfulness. It's not giving free rein to your thoughts and just tracking them. Let me respond this way, that I think having contemplative time is very important, and for people, for human beings. And for your 10 minutes in the morning, I think it's very important to have contemplative time where the mind is given free rein to think about what it needs to think about or process what needs to be there. And it's kind of like some people think that it's very important to dream at night so you can process stuff. I think it's very important to kind of have contemplative time where there's no attempt to try to control the mind or meditate in any particular way, or just let your mind kind of think freely. I do it a lot when I go walking or running. I do it sometimes when I drive. But it's very important. So I think it's very important. And I think a lot of people could find a lot of benefit and a lot of creative ideas and a lot of much better intimacy with themselves, that kind of. But I think it's very important to see that as being very different from Vipassana. Because Vipassana is not thinking about anything. In a sense, Vipassana, the awareness of mindfulness, it's kind of the awareness we're developing, is a silent awareness. So if you hear the bell, you can hear that bell outside of your thinking mind. The ear, the ear sense, the hearing sense, whatever that is, hears that without necessarily having to have a lot of thoughts about what you're hearing. You can actually have kind of a silent mind. The hearing itself is kind of silent of thoughts. You can be aware you're having an itch. And the awareness of the itch is kind of silent in and of itself. Then in addition to that, you might think about it. You can have a feeling, and you can know that feeling, but that knowing is not necessarily a thinking about it, just a knowing. It's kind of silent of thoughts. If you see something, you can see something, and you can see it with a silence of the mind without having to think about it. There's a lot of things you process every day in the course of walking around that you don't think about, but you see it, and there's a silent awareness of it, and then the processing that goes on more sub-thought-like. So the mindfulness practice is utilizing this ability to bring silent awareness to what's going on. And one of the things we can bring the silent awareness to is our thinking itself. You can know that you're thinking. And you don't want to get caught in your thinking or think that you're thinking about your thinking. You want to hold it in this very spacious, open, receptive awareness. It's kind of silent. So that's why I'm not comfortable calling vipassana contemplation. Yes, please.
I have a question about breathing and following breath.
Uh-huh.
In my daily life, my breath is less lung expanding than the breathing technique that you were describing today, not heard described before. And so there is less familiarity with the deep, more lung expanding breath here, and consequently, I have less relaxation, less comfort. Do you have a suggestion?
Practice in your daily life. Begin looking for sometimes regular times during your daily life where you can begin tuning in to your breathing. And first tune into it for several weeks without trying to change it at all. Just notice what your patterns of breathing are, where the tension, the holding might be, without any idea that it's supposed to be different. It might be uncomfortable, it might not. And just to kind of get to know it. Your job first is to become familiar with it. And then after a few weeks of becoming familiar with the way it is, then you might try seeing if you can relax some of the places. Maybe you can relax your stomach or relax your chest or relax something. Or maybe you can kind of try experimenting a little bit, taking some deeper breaths, take a deep in-breath, and then relax as you exhale. And experiment with different ways of breathing and seeing if you can find a way to breathe that tends to be more relaxing and releases some of the tension that's being held. And so to do this, choose some particular times during the day where it's easy to remember. For example, if you drive a lot, maybe every time you get in the car, before you turn on the car key, turn on the engine, you take maybe 2 minutes. Every time you come to a stop sign, you take 1 second. Every time you come to a red light, you take until the green light. Just to very kind of casually be with your breathing. Every time you're waiting in a line for something, maybe it's, you know, you're at Safeway. Lines mean I'm checking in with my breath. So you have some particular times through the day that are your time to check in with your breathing. And then by osmosis, I think it'll begin spilling over into other areas of your life. And before you know it, it'll be second nature. But you have to do the work of, you know, of practicing. A nice time to do it is before, for some people, is before going to sleep at night. Just lay there and explore the breath or be with the breath. Yes?
Following on what you just said to her, one of the books I was reading, I can't remember which, it said if you're a meditator, no moment is ever wasted. I really like that because, yeah, I started standing in line at Safeway and just calm and breathed, and I decided, yeah, a lot of moments don't have to be wasted that I had anxiety over that I thought were being wasted, because I've benefited from this a lot. And so, yeah, no moment is wasted.
Yeah, this is a very important point. In our society where people are often consumer-oriented or achievement-oriented, sometimes relationship oriented, wanting something from people or whatever, it's very hard to be accepting or find value in something which is not goal oriented or achievement oriented or materialistic oriented. You know, just being mindful of your breath quietly, standing in Safeway, is not going to increase your bank account. You know, it's not going to, it's all kinds of things it's not going to do for you. And so some people, it's very hard for them to imagine that it has any value to sit and stand in line at Safeway and just be mindful and stand there, that it has any particular value. Other things are much more important. It's more important to be racing off in your thoughts, thinking about balancing your checkbook, or I don't know what you think about, right? But no, it's actually quite profound and significant to begin a life of waking up. And any moment of mindfulness, any moment of being alert and awake and meditating, it goes unwasted. It's actually very significant. And with enough drops, the bathtub is filled. So don't underestimate the value of a drop of mindfulness. Because with enough drops, the bathtub is filled. So look for whatever opportunities you have. to practice. Yes?
One of the things I'm running into during my practice is boredom on focusing on the breath. And I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Boredom. Well, boredom is very interesting. And if you realize how interesting it is, you probably stop being bored. But boredom is very interesting, and it well deserves study. So when you get bored, don't take it for granted, or don't believe it, which is often a tendency with boredom, but rather turn the light of awareness to study the boredom. What's really going on inside of you when you're bored? And you might discover a range of things, because there's not one thing that causes boredom or one thing that occurs with boredom. When you start studying boredom like that and feeling what it's like in your body and what kind of thoughts are associated with it and the feelings associated with it and all that, boredom just evaporates because suddenly you've gotten very interested, so which is kind of nice, maybe. But also you might notice that boredom comes together with holding yourself at a distance from things or judging things. Or maybe it comes together with a kind of subtle kind of fear or a subtle kind of aversion. Or it comes together with a certain kind of judgmental quality of the mind. And you might notice that actually these other things are actually causing the boredom. Sometimes boredom is a symptom that we're holding ourselves at a distance from our experience. The breath is bored because we're keeping ourselves at a distance from it. We're judging it, we're aversive to it, we're afraid of it or something. And if we can let go of the distance we have between ourselves and the breath, the boredom will often go away. Sometimes boredom arises out of a sense of self, as I talked about earlier. Some people are very alert and interested if they're being praised. Some people are very alert and interested if they're being criticized or that there's a threat to the self. And some people are bored if the person they're talking with is neither praising them, exalting them or something, or somehow threatening them. If they're just kind of neutral and that person's not doing anything for my ego at all, you know, in one way or the other, and then they get bored with them. And the same thing with the breath. You know, oh, this breath, you have certain values about what's important in your life or what's threatening to your life, and the breath seems kind of neutral. And so your relationship to neutrality is boredom is a kind of very subtle aversion, so it's kind of aversion to it, because it doesn't really speak to the sense of self. You know, breath is not enhancing the sense of self, so why should I hang out here? So what I'm trying to suggest is, I'm not suggesting any of these is your thing, but it's very useful and important to turn your attention to the breath and hang out, and to the boredom and study it. Occasionally, in Vipassana practice, boredom. Sometimes boredom has no cause or seemingly no cause or condition to it. And it's useful just to take it as part of the terrain. As people go down through deeper and deeper layers of meditation, there's almost as if there's a layer of meditation where boredom is just part of that layer. And it's like suddenly the breath is like cardboard. I call it cardboard breath. It's my experience of it. And sometimes it's important just to know, oh, this is just, I'm at that layer where it's cardboard breath. And I just have to hang out and do my best. And that, you know, soon enough I'll move through it. And I don't have to evaluate or judge it or react to it or try to fix it or maybe even try to, I don't have to even maybe study it carefully. It's just part of the territory. And just hang out with it and just stay with the breath. So that's where faith or confidence is very important. So we just bring our faith, just, okay, I'll just hang in there with the breath anyway. They say it's useful and I'm bored, but I won't give the boredom much credence. I'll just hang in there anyway. So there's a lot of things to say, so experiment with some of the things I've said. And does it seem, any of that seem maybe?
Yeah, the distance from the breath that you talked about.
Yeah, great.
Thank you.
One more, anything before? Last one, please.
In regard to your answer about that, something about, you know, okay, there's boredom, and then you list off all of these sort of deeper insights into those kinds of things. How are you able to do that? Because, you know, if I did that and thought about, okay, where's the boredom coming from? be like boredom. But you're able to sort of cut down from another layer. How do you sort of do that?
The pure way of vipassana is simply to rely on your powers of observation, powers of knowing, of being aware of what's going on. So the basic principle of vipassana that we teach in the Spirit Rock tradition is we learn to pay attention to whatever is predominant in our experience. So if the breath is if boredom is starting to become predominant, then you want to bring your attention to the boredom. And just hold it in your awareness. Don't try to make it go away. Don't try to judge it. In a sense, accept its presence, accept its right to be there. But try to really be present for it in this silent awareness, to really get to know, be connoisseur of boredom. Where in your body is the feeling of boredom arise? So you develop your concentration, your stillness, on the boredom itself. As you do that, suddenly the boredom will start cracking open. And you might notice some things kind of between the cracks of it. You might notice that boredom involves certain judgments. Boredom involves a certain aversion. Boredom involves something else that's going on. So that reveals itself by itself. You don't have to go digging or analyzing to find what it is. Sometimes maybe you've heard a Dharma talk or read a book, and something that you've learned, somehow a little piece of understanding maybe returns to you as a magical moment when you're facing boredom. Oh, I heard boredom sometimes means you're holding myself at a distance at stuff. And so you might try. You might look for that. Is there some distance making here? And maybe that's useful. Or if you feel like you're bored for 2 or 3 months in your daily sitting, a long time, you might come and find a teacher. And the teacher might give you a little piece of understanding that kind of points you to where to look. The danger with pointing and having some understanding is that then the practice can start becoming manipulative. You know, negotiating, kind of bartering. Okay, if I do this, then I'll get a better experience. The basic idea of mindfulness is whatever your experience is, it's okay for it to be that way. What we're trying to do is to develop a clear, independent, free seeing of that experience. Boredom is just as good as wonderful bliss from the point of view of mindfulness. So the pure essence of vipassana is to cultivate this independent quality of knowing. It can know whatever is happening. It doesn't really matter what we know. So if you're going to sharpen a knife, it doesn't really matter which whetstone you sharpen the knife. It just matters that you sharpen it on some knife. You're sharpening the knife of awareness. It doesn't matter what awareness knows. It just matters that your awareness is becoming more independent and free and clear and silent. So we want to be very careful. You don't get caught up in endlessly manipulating, trying to change your experience. A little bit is okay. Does it make sense?
Yeah.
So I hope that was useful. All that teaching tonight. What I'd like to do this evening is a little bit different. I'd like to it's 8:15, and rather than ending with a short sitting, I would like to kind of formally end our Thursday evening sitting in a couple of minutes. And then stay beyond this time, to 8:30 or longer if some of you would like. And stay and talk to any of you who might want to talk about this purchase of a church that we're about to do in Redwood City. Our sitting group, which has been in Palo Alto since 1988, maybe? 89. We've slowly grown over these last 13 years. And now we've become quite large. We have these two meetings, Monday evening here and Thursday evening here, and Sunday morning in Portola Valley, and one day sittings in St. Mark's down the street. And as we're growing, we'd like to be able to do more programs and be more available for our growing population, our growing community of meditators, and be more available to the wider community in all kinds of interesting ways. And so for a long time, we've been working towards having our own center, our own building, that we can just do whatever we want then and have our own home. And it's finally happening. And it's happening in Redwood City, which for some people living in Palo Alto or living south of here has been a little bit of a shock because it's because of the commute and the distance. And I apologize for that. The real estate prices in Palo Alto make it a little bit difficult. We tried here in Palo Alto, and it was very hard. We tried very hard to find a place, some of the places that became available. And our decision was that Redwood City is within the orbit of our kind of geographical area that we're kind of centered in. And it seemed acceptable enough to move to Redwood City. And the church is being sold to us under phenomenally generous terms. It's more of a spiritual exchange than a monetary exchange, where the ministers who own the church, the Christian mystics, and they were more interested in their church going to someone who carried on the same spirit of spirituality that they seemed to have, more interested in that than the money that they got from the church sale. And they called me up in January, not to talk about buying the church or selling the church, but to do a spiritual interview. They spent about 2 hours on the phone with them being spiritually interviewed, like for a job interview, to kind of see if, you know, I spiritually qualified, I guess. And our group, whether our group spiritually qualified for what, you know, for their church. And so they've been very eager to sell it to us. They like very much what we do. They like very much our practice and our meditation, and they're inspired. They've checked with God, and God is really wants us to have the church. So, you know, it's coming with very good, you know, references. And they're really lovely people. I feel very, very fortunate to know them. I think very profoundly spiritual people, because they're kind of tried very hard, not hard, but anyway, they have offered us very, very generous terms for the sale. So I feel and we've been there. It seems like a very good place for us. It seems like a very nice building. Maybe a little bit on the small side of what we would have wished, but certainly adequate for what we can do. And so we've had a series of meetings and discussions about this since January. I haven't talked about it much on Thursday evenings, but when I brought it up on this last Monday evening for discussion, then we spent the whole Monday evening talking about it, 45 minutes. And to me, it didn't seem somehow right to devote the whole evening tonight to talking about the church. But I do want to give you a chance, those of you who might be interested, to talk about it and any kind of concerns you might have, to be able to talk about that. So what I'd like to do is just kind of end the evening. And those of you who like to stay behind, kind of stay here or come up closer, and we can continue talking about the church in Redwood City, what it means to buy the church, what it means for our community here in Palo Alto, and whatever is on your minds about it. Does that seem okay? So I want to thank you very much. It was very nice to be back. I was gone because 2 weeks ago I had a tonsillectomy, and so I'm still a little bit recovering from it. It's much harder as an adult. I joke that it's my inner child had it was finally taken out, and it was very painful. But I'm happy to be back. I'll see you next week.